Good evening. Welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. Why all the fuss about gay marriage? San Francisco author and queer anti-assimilationist rabble-rouser Matilda Bernstein Sycamore promises to inject some sense into the disastrous gay marriage debate, to dissect the travesties of post-gay San Francisco, and perhaps poke some fun at NPR, Bikram Yoga, and more in the next half hour. She'll also read a little. She's found a few passages that can be read on public radio from her extensive writings. Matilda Bernstein Sycamore has written two novels, So Many Ways to Sleep Badly and Pulling Taffy, has edited four anthologies on subjects including sex workers and resisting assimilation, and is working on a new anthology called Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots, and a memoir titled The End of San Francisco. She has a definitely contrarian view of marriage equality and establishment gaze. The titles of the previous anthologies give a hint. Nobody Passes, Rejecting the Rules of Gender and Conformity. That's Revolting, Queer Strategies for Resisting Assimilation. And Dangerous Families, Queer Writing on Surviving. And Tricks and Treats, Sex Workers Write About Their Clients. That one, by the way, was translated into Italian. Sycamore was involved in ACT UP in the early 1990s and Fed Up Queers in the late 1990s. Also was the host of the first gay shame event in New York and was one of the instigators of gay shame in San Francisco. And in 2008, Sycamore was included in Utney Reader's magazine's 50 Visionaries Who Are Changing the World. I don't know where to start. Matthew, Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I should say welcome back to Out in the Bay. Marilyn interviewed Matilda 3 or 4 years ago after That's Revolting was published, I believe. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. So there's an expanded edition out now. So how about starting us off with part of your introduction to That's Revolting?
Sure, absolutely. I'll read a brief excerpt from the introduction. Gay assimilationists have created the ultimate genetically modified organism, combining violent strains of nationalism, patriarchy, patriotism, and consumerism, and delivering them in one deadly product: state-sanctioned matrimony. Gay marriage proponents are anxious to discard all those tacky hues of lavender and pink in favor of the good old stars and stripes, literally draping themselves in old glory at every pro-marriage demonstration as the U.S. occupies Iraq, overthrows the only democratically elected government in the history of Haiti, funds the Israeli war on the Palestinians, and makes the whole world safe for multinational corporations to plunder indigenous resources. The tyranny of assimilation lies in the way the borders are policed. For decades, there's been a strife within queer politics and cultures between assimilationists and liberationists, conservatives and radicals. Never before, however, has the assimilationist conservative side held such a stranglehold over popular representations of what it means to be queer. Gay marriage advocates brush aside generations of queer efforts to create new ways of loving, lusting for, and caring for one another in favor of a 1950s model of white picket fence, we're just like you, normalcy. The ultimate irony of gay liberation is that it has made it possible for straight people to create more fluid gender, sexual, and social identities, while mainstream gay people salivate over state-sanctioned Tiffany wedding bans and participatory patriarchy. If gay assimilationists wanted actual progress, they'd start by funding for the end of marriage. Duh. And universal access to the services that marriage can sometimes help procure: housing, health care, citizenship, tax breaks, and inheritance rights. But doesn't the creation of a world where it's safe for gay Republicans, gay realtors, and gay action figures to come out of the closet and live full, healthy, happy lives, doesn't this create more options for all of us? No, it creates more options for gay Republicans and Democrats to support a warmongering, bigoted agenda, more options for gay realtors to sell overpriced property and advise their clients on how best to evict long-term tenants, and more options for gay action figures to drop bombs. Wait, can action figures drop bombs?
Okay, intriguing. And it's a rant. That's you've got a few more pages there where you didn't read.
Oh yeah, I mean I just read a little tiny excerpt. I mean there's plenty more, and the whole book is filled with wonderful stories of resisting assimilation.
So who's included in this anthology? Give us some little tidbits or overview.
Sure, all sorts of crazies. You know, from people who are around at the very beginning of gay liberation. Ferd Egan has a piece called "Dykes and Fags Want Everything: Dreaming with the Gay Liberation Front," and so it's about coming of age for him. You know, in the '60s, and you know, it's sort of this overview from the '60s until now. There's a great piece called "Queering the Underground" about the George Jackson Brigade, which were radical queers who bombed buildings in the Northwest. Tommy Avicoli Mecca, a local hero, has a piece called "It's All About Class," about, you know, foregrounding class, you know, in gay liberation. There's a piece by Choice Cuts, Charlie Anders, who's also local, talking about, you know, choosing our gender and transforming our, you know, gender, sexual, social identities.
So let me ask you.
Absolutely.
Last week we had on a couple of guys from who were in this movie called 8, The Mormon Proposition. And they were these two ex-Mormons, former Mormons who, you know, want to get married, and they got married, and they, you know, quit the Mormon church because, and one of the moms was on, and she was, you know, she had to quit the church too because she supported her gay son and said the Mormon church shouldn't be doing what they're doing. And I'm just wondering, there's like, is there a common ground here? Where is there a common ground? Because they're like, you know, we finally realized after Proposition 8 passed, now we realize, oh, you know, we're not full citizens yet, and we're still probably not going to be for a long time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the rhetoric of full citizenship is really dangerous, because most people in this country who aren't born rich, straight, white, and male are not full citizens. So when the gay marriage movement says, oh, you know, if we just have marriage, then we'll be full citizens, you know, it's staking its claim on the wrong side of the barbed wire. Mm-hmm. So instead of talking about, you know, oh, let's see, what are the big issues going on right now? We talk about, you know, immigration, right? And we talk about, you know, ICE agents detaining people without cause, you know, murdering people on U.S. borders. And, you know, the gay marriage proponents say, oh, well, you know, gay marriage is going to solve that. So, you know, if you're trying to get in this country and ICE approaches you on the border with a machine gun and you say, oh, wait a second, I'm married, you know, it's really not going to help you. And so I think the gay marriage movement is all about, you know, protecting the privilege of the people who have the most, rather than, you know, furthering their options for all of us. So instead of talking about universal access to basic needs, like, you know, remember healthcare, you know, housing, food, you know, maybe sex, you know, and love. Aren't these things that everyone should have?
So in your, sex and love. By the way, a little disclaimer here, because as I mentioned before, the new book, Matilda's new book, So Many Ways to Sleep Badly, is about the experiences. The protagonist is a sex worker, a hustler. Is that the right term? Is that
a
derogatory
term? Yeah, feel free.
Term?
Any terms you want.
Not, you know, like call boy, whatever.
Oh, no. Hustler's great. Hustler's,
yeah, well, that's what the word I thought I remembered. The point I'm trying to make here is that, you know, there's a possibility we'll be talking about sex, maybe even gay sex. So if you don't think your kids should be listening, you might want to say that now. But we're not going to use dirty words. We're going to do it in a very NPR-style word. Or my parents, Mom, Dad, Marion, Pete, stop listening. I dated an escort for a while. I don't know why. I need to disclose that all of a sudden, but I just thought I would. I lost my point. I hate it when I do that, especially when I'm on live radio. But things happen. Your mother, you have this little essay that you wrote for The Skinny, which is a UK website. And you talk about your mother living in Washington, D.C. She just moved to this neighborhood, this a newly gentrified neighborhood. And, you know, a lot of gays are moving in. And she is approached on the street and asked by this canvasser, do you want to support gay rights? And can you tell us a little bit about your mother's transformation on the whole gay rights, you know, continuum from, you know, when you first came out? And
Sure. I mean, I think when I first came out, actually, my mother, who was a therapist, as well as also was my father, the first thing they wanted me to do was to see a therapist in order to change my sexuality. So they suggested Charles Socarides, the famous conversion therapist. That was here in San Francisco, actually, in a North Beach Italian restaurant. And since, you know, over the years, of course, I've been talking about...
Wait a minute. The sex therapy was in an Italian restaurant?
Oh, well, we didn't actually... I luckily refused to go to that particular therapist.
Okay.
But maybe in the back of the Italian restaurant. I mean, he does have a gay son, of course. And I think over the years, of course, I've been talking about the nightmare of assimilation and the way it, you know, leaves everyone out, right? And so, and talking about, well, you know, a queer vision, what does it mean to be queer? You know, it's like challenging the status quo, creating more options for people to create, transform, you know, express their gender, sexual, social, political identities, and talking about how marriage, you know, really limits those options rather than creating more. And so when my mother recently, you know, saw these canvassers in Washington, D.C., you know, saying, you know, do you support marriage? Do you support, you are actually say, do you support gay rights? And then you get closer and they're like, you know, support gay marriage. And she actually was able to say, well, actually, what about people who don't want to get married? You know? And so I think for me, that story, what it tells is, you know, anyone can relate to that particular perspective. You know, it shouldn't be, married people shouldn't be the only ones with rights, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's a very interesting point. And I also recall after the, you know, when marriage was, when the California Supreme Court said, oh, it's illegal to deny gay people the right, same-sex couples, the right to be married in California. And then there was this wave of marriages. And I was like, oh, great, now I don't have any prospects. I'm a loser now. I'm even more of a loser. And it did seem like that ability to... live our lives and build our relationships in a way that we wanted to, because we didn't have the option of marriage as, you know, the standard format. We had to construct our own. And as you said before, straight people have to some extent used those alternative models in a way to, like, hey, the man doesn't have to take out the trash and the woman doesn't have to just change the baby's diapers or whatever.
Exactly. I mean, most straight people know that marriage is a disaster. I mean, and most queer people, we grew up either in marriage or the results of something like marriage at some point. And we shouldn't grow up then and be like, oh, well, let's see, I grew up in an abusive household. You know, my parents were beating me. I ran away. I was living on the streets or whatever. And then say, oh, well, now I just want that same thing without even changing it, you know? And I think when Gavin Newsom, you know, sort of like legalized gay marriage in quotation marks as a gesture to solidify his gay power base, you know, he went, you know, overnight from like barely beating Matt Gonzalez at the polls to having an 80% approval rating. And I think... also, San Francisco really became queer San Francisco, queer and gay San Francisco became dramatically more conservative in that moment. The options were narrowing for everyone. And I think San Francisco, obviously, for generations, has been a central place where people are creating radical, transformative alternatives for loving and lusting for and taking care of one another that are not based on state-sanctioned contracts.
Mm-hmm. You're hearing Out in the Bay on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Eric Jansen. My guest is Matilda Bernstein Sigmart. Bernstein?
Absolutely. Sounds
Thank
good to
you.
Me.
I just want to make sure it wasn't Bernstein.
Perfect.
Reading from her books and challenging the gay establishment. This is the only broadcast of Out in the Bay during KALW's fall membership drive, by the way. We're an independent show. If you support what we're doing, please let KALW know that by joining or making an extra contribution to KALW now. I'm going to take less than a minute now. I'll be right back to conversing with Matilda some more, someone you're not likely to hear on mainstream public radio, certainly not on commercial radio. And I think perhaps we might even hear Matilda poke a little bit of fun at pledge drives if we have time for that little excerpt. Extra incentive this hour is that you can pick up one or two of Matilda Bernstein Sycamore's books as a thank you gift if you join or increase your support level to $75 for one book. That's Revolting, the anthology that he just read the introduction out of, or So Many Ways to Sleep Badly, which is the novel we're going to hear from soon. $75 for either one or $120 for the both of them. 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. Or go online to KALW.org and choose the level you can afford. To inspire you, here's a sampling from Matilda's novel, So Many Ways to Sleep Badly, which is set right here in San Francisco and Oakland.
Absolutely. It all takes place right here in the Bay Area. And I'm going to read just a little excerpt towards the end of the book. And luckily, it's a non-linear novel, so you can start anywhere you want. This is from the second
to last. Because I've been skimming around. I've been skimming around trying to find a page that, you know, we could actually
read
on public radio.
You can read on air,
But thank goodness you're taking that responsibility.
This page is not even censored. Well, actually, there is one censor mark.
Okay.
But you won't even notice because I've already edited it.
All right. Go for it.
There won't be any beeps. Perhaps a new album by Wynton Marsalis will make it easier to put the children to sleep at night. But now I present to you the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, Fire Engines in the Rain, and a lifetime supply of grapefruit-flavored packing peanuts. Rue says those aren't packing peanuts, they're pomelos, but they taste the same. I keep thinking no one's calling me back because it's Friday. Then I realize it's Thursday. Then I keep thinking no one's calling me back because it's Friday. Kid Koala rescues me from oblivion with that crazy maudlin moaning and groaning only possible with amazing feats of turntable madness. Wait, is it maudlin or melancholy? I don't have a clue what he's doing, but it sounds like a trumpet and one of those big string instruments mixed with a foghorn in the rain. I love the foghorn. But then I'm sad. Just like that. The sentence ends, and then I'm sad again. Should I go on a walk? Okay, now Kid Koala's got dogs barking into violins as the records skip and the melody becomes a marching band in tandem with horror soundtracks backwards. Anything is possible until my stomach ache. Well, that's what you get for eating beans at 2:36 a.m. On NPR, America is one of the most complex and vibrant brands I've ever met. Someone actually says that. She's a former State Department official or something like that. Her job didn't work out because she moved in right after 9/11 and no one liked her. The best part of the Medea Project performance is this dance number one woman does, falling and collapsing in high heels. I want to gasp, but I almost can't breathe. It's so good. Reminds me of what I want to do if I wasn't so injured. Afterwards, there's a dyke who moved here from Chicago talking about looking for the other black people, and she didn't find many until she worked at the jail. There they were, San Francisco natives, all of them. I wonder if I'll ever find exercise that doesn't hurt. Rue comes over and I have a breakdown about everybody's inconsistencies. Then we go on a walk for 7 blocks until I'm completely exhausted. At least it's fun to lie in Rue's arms and hope to be saved. An NPR reporter on the BBC. I still think of England as Mother England. We're all English in one way or another. Pledge drive. It's only 33 cents a day to support Mother England. Peter Ustinov died today. He won his first Oscar for training slaves to fight as gladiators in Spartacus. James Bond says, when Peter and I had sex, it was like a train hitting Mother Teresa.
Wow. Your style has been compared to William S. Burroughs and that other guy whose name I can't pronounce.
Oh, David Wonorovich, who
David
I do
Wonorovich.
Love. I love David Wonorovich.
Yeah. Okay. And by the way, you know, it's just like had to do the math real quick in my head. Well, 33 cents a day. Well, actually, that is almost exactly what it would cost if someone was to pitch now and get both of your books. $10 a month. I think that works out to 33 cents a day.
It sounds like a good deal to me.
Maybe I'm wrong about that. No, that's about right. Anyway, 800-525-9917. You know, I haven't read much of the book, but I started to read it, and it's true. I felt like I'm just been plopped into this hustler's head, midstream of consciousness. There's jumbled thoughts. It's nonlinear, but gradually we learn things about this person. He's an incest survivor. He dresses faggoty style. He's a vegan. Sounds a little like you.
It does sound like me. What a coincidence. How strange. I don't know how that happened.
And before that, you mentioned something earlier. You mentioned something about dressing in pink and purple and how that's not supposed to, you know, like people don't want to, gay guys don't want to dress in pink and purple. And
True enough.
What are you wearing? Because, you know,
I don't know.
Describe
yourself. Can the radio audience see us?
It is a purple T-shirt, pink belt. Because it's so warm in the studio, you took off your
pink sweat on my
shirt
face.
And then the... the flowered jacket over it, and you know, it's very it brings me back to my childhood, frankly.
Okay, yeah, and it sounds like the character in so many ways to Sleep Badly. I think I was
walking through San Francisco Golden Gate Park dressed not too unlike that when you weren't born yet, but I'm not
perfect,
sure about
perfect.
That.
That sounds fun. I'm all for that.
Okay, so let's see. Do we want to read another section from this, or do you want to? Now you've got a reading coming up on September 28th at Modern Times Bookstore.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
And that is because you've got this new memoir in progress called "The End of San Francisco."
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm actually leaving San Francisco after living here 14 of the last 20 years. You know, after being a writer, performer, activist, you know, doing all sorts of crazy things. It's time for me to be on my way. But I've written this really big project. It's a memoir called The End of San Francisco. It started out with about 1,200 pages of material, if you can believe that.
I believe it.
And now I've edited it down. I have about 250. But I'm a super neurotic editor, so I'm always constantly editing. This is going to be my goodbye reading. Goodbye to San Francisco, September 28th, Modern Times, 6:30.
Which is on Valencia Street.
Exactly, Valencia and 20th.
Okay.
And there'll be refreshments at 6:30, and then 7 p.m. is the reading. And I'll be reading, it'll be a very special preview of the book, because the book won't be out for a while, because the publishing industry is very slow.
So you're just like, will this become apparent after you read this, or should I ask you now if you're leaving San Francisco because you're fed up with it, or what? I mean, so many artists are leaving San Francisco.
Yeah. I am fed up with it. I mean, San Francisco has been the most formative place for me, you know, as a radical queer outsider, you know, and creating my own ways of, you know, activism, of community, of culture, of sex, of love, of, you know, failure, of drama, of glamour, all of that. But it's time for me to move on, at least for a few years, and then I can decide if I want to move back. I've actually left before. You know, I first moved here in 92. I left in 94. I came back in 95. I left in 96.
Some of us have bounced around a lot.
And then I've been back for the last 10 years, but it's time, I think, to try somewhere else, at least for a while.
So let's hear from The End of San Francisco, a work in progress.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. This is from a chapter at the middle, which is about the early 90s in San Francisco. We were scarred and broken and brutalized, but determined to create something else, something we could live with, something we could call home or healing or even just help. I need help here. Can you help? We were incest survivors, whores, vegans, runaways, anarchists, dropouts, drug addicts, sluts, activists, and freaks, trying not to disappear. We paraded down the street in bold and ragged clothes, too big or too small. We shared thrift store treasures and recipes and strategies for getting day glow hair to last. We exchanged manifestos and zines and flyers and gossip, got in dramatic fights over politics, over the weather, over clothing, over who was sleeping with whom. We held each other. We painted each other's nails and broke down. Honey, we broke down. We were the first generation of queers to grow up knowing that desire meant AIDS, meant death. And so it made sense that when we got away from the other death, the one that meant marriage, house in the suburbs, a lifetime of brutality, both interior and exterior, and call this success, or keep trying for more brutality. But when we got away, it made sense that everywhere people were dying of AIDS and drug addiction and suicide, because we had only known death. Some of the dead were among us, just like us, just trying to survive. Others were more in the distance, the elders we barely got to know except through their loss. We went crazy and cried a lot, or went crazy and stopped crying, or just went crazy. It was us against them. That's what we believed. They were straight people. They were abusers. They were rapists and landlords and cops. They were parents and politicians and anyone with designer clothes. They were the gay people who congregated in the Castro, apathetic, straight-acting gay men who went to the gym and dressed like clones in white t-shirts and baseball caps, who bought new Doc Martens because they were trendy and not because they knew anything, gay men who hated women and fat people and people of color and sissies and anyone who was different, really. And we were different. We were absolutely certain of that. We were different. We weren't different, and that was the problem. I mean, we were different, but not different enough. Even now, now that the mission is rarely or barely the same place, it's still the same place in the imagination, more than 15 years of gentrification later. I try not to go to the mission at all. Not just because it's the partying suburbanites who live there now. They live everywhere. We were once partying suburbanites too, many of us. But we came to San Francisco to escape. We thought we were creating our own system of understanding, our own values, our own ways of challenging the status quo.
Okay. You go, girl. Now, I remember that even being a phrase that you didn't appreciate. That was part of the a phrase that you used in the book earlier, like the people that don't know, they just don't get it. Like straight people would say, you go, girl.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how things, you know, travel that way. So, yeah, now only really like a very clueless straight person who's trying to be like really, really understanding would say something like, you go, girl.
I'll try not to use it anymore.
Well, so, I mean, if you're using it in the original glamour, then it's a different story, okay?
Oh, thank God, okay. So why are faggots so afraid of faggots?
That's a good question. And so I've been working on this anthology. It's pretty much done now. And
what do you mean by that question, though? This is the anthology that's coming up, and you actually had some reading or performance some time back, a couple
Absolutely.
Years ago.
Yeah, I did a
same
few.
Title.
Yeah,
and that's
exactly.
Actually, I noticed that in a passage in the new book, so many ways
exactly.
To see
that. I mean, that's where I originally thought of the title, you know, was, you know, this question, because I think it is a really important question. You know, here we have, and I think part of it, as with all my anthologies, in some way they emerge from personal experience, you know. And so in my experience, I'm really inspired by sort of genderqueer, transgender, you know, gender-defiant kind of subcultures that I'm a part of, but I'm also a part of, you know, gay male sexual culture. I mean, and I think that gay male sexual spaces are kind of worse. You know, the values in them are worse than, like, straight male homophobic values. So it's almost like demanding your adherence to the worst norms of masculinity in order, you know, to get a blowjob or something, right? And so for me, the question is, you know, if this is the nightmare, you know, these spaces where of mandatory masculinity, you know, unquestioning and unappreciating objectification, you know, long-term neglect of self-care, you know, annihilating drug addiction, an endless quest for dissatisfaction at any cost. You know, if that's gay male sexual culture, then where have we gone wrong? You know, and so, and my question is, you know, what about, like, you know, a faggotry, a more transformative faggotry that, like, is challenging.
Both, and expressive, maybe.
Exactly. Expressive, flamboyant, you know, dissident, both politically, sexually, culturally, you know, all of that, you know, the integration of where is that? You know, and I know that it's not in gay male sexual spaces, unfortunately. And so my question is, like, how, you know, if this is where, you know, if supposedly our desire is what started this whole queer thing, and it's led to this, like, how do we change? How do we create something more?
And you get back to desire, maybe, yeah?
Exactly. Well, you know, or at least bring desire somewhere else. You know what I mean? We got to...
You know what? I wish I'd taken the general manager, Matt Martin, up and when he offered me a full hour, because we could have gone for a full hour easily.
Ooh, I would
Unfortunately,
loved
it. Our time is up. So I've got to say thank you so much to Matilda Bernstein-Sycamore coming in and reading from your two books. Well, actually, you've got more books than that, but the two that she read from. Oh, see, now this is part of it, too. We didn't even get to that. But,
well, flip
but
it around. I'm all
You know
for
what?
It.
Go to his website, her website, and get the thing on gay male sexuality, that he's part of that space, but she's Matilda.
Absolutely.
Because it's about transforming our... ideas about gender.
Yeah, okay. And if anyone wants to talk more about all those ideas, come to Modern Times on September 28th.
Yes, you've been listening to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco, independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman.